Hello, this is Thomas Keegan with LibertarianProgressive.com, where if you visit the website, you'll find over about 45 interviews with independent and third-party candidates who are going to be on the ballot this year. And today we're interviewing Craig Bowden, a Libertarian candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in District Number 1 in Utah. He's running as a Libertarian, and he's the only third-party candidate on the ballot in his area. And we're going to have some questions for Craig here, but I have a question for you real quick. Most Americans, according to the most recent polls, say they would throw all the candidates out. They would not reelect the current incumbents. Let me ask you, who would you replace those candidates with? And if you had the opportunity, are you going to use it? Because every 2 years, the House of Representatives, you get a chance to clean out the House. And we're actually trying to make that decision even easier for you by interviewing these candidates. You're going to have about 50 candidates who are on the ballot, and not only that, the only third option in their district. And Craig, you can visit his website, actually. It's going to be Craig, C-R-A-I-G, the number 4, congress.org. And according to the website here, it says Craig Bowden is a business owner, Marine Corps veteran, an author. He's a father, a husband, a concerned citizen of the United States. Finally, Craig is a Libertarian candidate for Utah's 1st Congressional District. Craig Bowden is always interested in hearing from the American people at large, especially the people who live in Utah's 1st District. He answers as many, and no issue is too large for him to tackle with a response. So let me ask you, is that someone that you would replace the current Congress people with? Let's find out. Craig, good to talk to you today, and thank you for joining the show. What got you interested in, you know, running this year? Have you ever ran before for Congress? And how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'll start with the last question first. Doing pretty good tonight. Just finished a visit with my parents and got to talk some politics with my dad, so that's always a good time. As to what got me into politics, it would probably be my dad. He was the kind of guy who would listen to talk radio in the mornings on my way to school and find something to yell at the radio about. And about by the time I got home, he was writing off the next letter to the editor. And so I kind of took to his example and started writing some of my own letters to the editor, especially during the Clinton administration, during the gun bans on what they like to call assault weapons. I prefer sporting rifles myself, but that's what started it all. I have run for office. I ran for the 1st Congressional District in 2014, and then unfortunately, as a third party, didn't quite make the cut. After that, I ran in 2015 for a county-level position on a policy council governing the Head Start program, and that election I won. I served a one-year term, helped try to balance the budget a little bit better and institute some spending cuts. And so now I'm ready for round two with Congress, and that's where we are today.
Right, and have there been any debates so far for this office, and are there any debates coming up?
You know, unfortunately, the really big televised debate, they decided to exclude me over a little bit more than 0.5%, so I didn't quite make the cut for the really big one. Last night, there was a Meet the Candidates night where they had a forum where we were offered the chance to actually have rebuttals. Unfortunately, Congressman Bishop decided to not show up, so I had to speak to his surrogate who was there, but we still did really well at that forum. After that, the next one that we've got is actually scheduled up in Brigham City, which is up in northern Utah, and hopefully he'll actually attend that one, but since I typically tend to kick his behind in these debates and forums, he usually tends to not show up.
So you do have one scheduled in Brigham City. Is that going to be a full debate?
It's going to be basically where the citizens in Birmingham City are going to be able to submit questions that are addressed to specific offices, because there will be more than one office at this forum. But there is a lot of weight on the congressional district, so we end up getting a lot more questions. And essentially, it's a typical debate format where you're offered, you know, about a minute and a half to respond to the question. Every candidate gives their response, and then there's going to be the chance for a rebuttal as well.
Well, that's a pretty good format. I mean, debates are always good. Long-time American tradition to have the debates ever since, you know, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Ross Perot, Jesse Ventura. It's kind of like the chicken and the egg. I mean, if you don't have the percentage, but you're not in the debate, then, you know, which comes first? Usually the debates should determine the percentage instead of vice versa. And so the debates can educate and inform the people. And it doesn't say anything about you or your candidacy per se. It says something about the forum that's hosting the debate and your opponent for not, you know, inviting you to the debate more so. So if you were, let's just say the tables were turned and in 2 years you are the incumbent and you're defending, you know, if you decide to run again for reelection and you had some up-and-comers that wanted to challenge you, would you use the same tactics and avoid the debates, or would you promise to engage in debates, Craig?
Oh, I always encourage healthy debate. It's something that the American people deserve. It's, you know, something that the voters of Utah deserve. They should be able to hear from every ballot qualified candidate. You know, the people that are seeking to represent them in Washington, D.C. So there's no way that I would be using these tactics to dodge and come up with excuses for why I'm not present, or, you know, if the debate commission decided to exclude one of them, I would, you know, use my influence to say, okay, well, you're not going to have me either, because ultimately, you know, everybody should be able to be there and be heard.
Sure. And you're just as on the ballot as anyone else. I mean, this is a congressional race here, and the taxpayers are paying to print your name on the ballot, and you had to do what you had to do to get on the ballot. And so I wonder whose best interest it is, whether it's the incumbent or the major party candidate, or if it's in the voters' best interest not to hear all the candidates. I mean, it really goes down to fair competition. And if they're excluding you, they're not really just excluding you. They're excluding the voters from having, you know, an open debate. And so we hope that, you know, some decisions are changed and you're included in the debates, that there are more debates, et cetera. As after all, many elections, you know, have been somewhat determined by debates. Hopefully that's not always the case this year if there isn't going to be as many. But, well, let's go through your issues on your website here. And you have here listed government surveillance, limited military involvement overseas, ending the war on drugs. Now, these are big impact issues. You also have here listed on your website, a patriot is not someone who will just die for his beliefs, but one who will live every day for them. And so, you know, when you were in the Marine Corps, you were fighting to protect and defend the Constitution, the United States of America itself. So when you look at the current government surveillance, what do you think about that?
I can tell you one thing. While I was serving, I sure as heck wasn't defending it, because all that was going on while I was in. So that's why I decided to speak up now. You know, once you actually take that oath, it kind of gets your brain spinning about what it really means. And when you look at things like the Patriot Act, the Freedom Act, you know, all these things that they're using to essentially collect data on the American people, we end up with a situation where the right to privacy, the right to be secure in your possession, in your home, are violated daily. And so it's not right. And, you know, I look at those things and if they're willing to disregard something as important as the Fourth Amendment, what else are they willing to disregard?
Yeah, wouldn't you have to pass another amendment to get rid of the Fourth Amendment? I mean, there's, you know, so many things like the right to feel secure in your property, places, or things, to need a independent judge to issue a warrant, to be able to feel secure that, you know, you're going to have a trial by jury of your peers, to have the evidence presented in front of you so you can dispute that evidence, to know your accusers, to have a speedy and fair trial, and, you know, and any other due process. And that's what makes America great. That's why people decide to come here instead of some other places. And so what is the climate or the temperature in your district? And I don't mean like, you know, how many degrees it is out there, but, you know, how are you going to try to build consensus to have people, you know, maybe consider a libertarian or you as an individual candidate versus what we've had basically for the last over 100 years since the Republican Party itself, basically as the first third party candidate, I guess, that became successful. How are you going to convince people? How are you going to build consensus? How are you going to add more competition and compete here coming up?
Well, you know, you've got to speak to the heart of the issues, and you do that by not just sitting behind a computer board. You know, you can sit there and type all you want on the internet, but until you get that human connection, you're not really going to connect with the voters. Essentially, what I've seen in my time here on Earth, there's a disconnect between the people in Washington, D.C. and the people they represent, and it ends up becoming what I like to call D.C. Island Syndrome. And they're basically surrounded by lobbyists almost, you know, 24/7. And so what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be out there, as I have been since I started this campaign, knocking on doors, making phone calls, attending, you know, those public events like these candidate forums, any candidates nights, the college political fairs, anything I can get my hands on. I've been to just about every county fair, you know, walking and talking, and that's really how you reach the hearts of the people. And then on the issues, when it comes to things like surveillance, I mean, that actually impacts Utah directly, because down in a city called Draper, we actually have one of the largest NSA collection facilities. And it's a twofold attack when it comes to this facility. So there's the civil liberties end, where we actually are, you know, standing up for the rights of every American citizen to, you know, have that due process, which includes a warrant and the accusation of a crime before they're starting to, you know, collect things on you. The second part is that the Draper facility is actually estimated to use 1.3 million gallons of water per day. Now, one of the things that really kind of irks me is that Utah, we are a dry state. We're what's considered a steppe climate, and so we only get about 15 inches of rainfall on average per year. And when you look at the amount of water that this facility is going to be using, it's enough to hydrate the entire state every single day. So that's every citizen, a full gallon of water every single day. And it's absurd that they're going to be using that to just cool down computers to violate other people's rights.
Yeah, that sounds almost, yeah, hard to believe. I think I saw in the news maybe about 10 years ago or something, there was a town in Utah where they were fining people for collecting water on their own property or something like that. And now they're going to have this big old NSA hub, you know, just devouring water to cool down computer systems. And Utah, I don't know, it seems like somewhat of a independent type attitude as far as wanting to, I think there's a group of people wanting to coin their own money and also declaring themselves independent, maybe of the Patriot Act or the UN or something like that. So a little bit of an independent streak there, or there can be. What about the war on drugs? Now, you do have that listed as an issue, and that goes into civil liberties, goes into prohibition, goes into states' rights, regulations, agriculture. But there are a lot of people who do feel like, you know, they don't want to be in neighborhoods where, you know, they walk out of their home and people are doing drugs on the corner or something like that. But that's not really the whole picture, is it? I mean, so you want to end the war on drugs. You know, Afghanistan's the longest running war that we've been in so far, even though I don't think it's declared, but longer than the Vietnam War, which I guess also wasn't declared. But actually, the war on drugs has been going on even longer than that. Can you tell us about that, sir?
Sure. You know, with the war on drugs, I personally believe, and if you look at some of the historical evidence, it really was made to kind of keep people under control. During the Nixon administration, you know, they started, you know, attacking the use to get rid of hippies and degenerates. And so it was a way to basically incarcerate people who were using their free speech without violating their free speech. So that's really the root of it. And then it turned into a cash crop for government. I mean, so many issues branch off of the war on drugs, like civil asset forfeiture, where law enforcement is able to confiscate, you know, property, money, vehicles, things like that, to benefit their own ends. And then when you look at the civil liberties end of it, you know, it's your body, your choice. You know, you hear that from Democrats all the time when it comes to abortion, but if they really believed that, then they would have been the first to sit there and try to sponsor legislation that would actually put an end to the war on drugs. But you see candidates like Hillary Clinton who are saying they're going to continue it and, as a matter of fact, expand it. So it's not about that. It's about preserving that government power. They don't really seem to care about the civil liberties of a person having the ability to consume something when there's no harm to another person. Also, when we look at, you know, the fiscal side of things, it makes sense to actually start pushing to end the war on drugs, because we're looking at roughly $61 billion every single year that's used for incarceration as well as interdiction. And we've been doing it for decades, and yet drugs are still being used, drugs are still being sold, drugs are still being made. So the government throwing money at it, throwing law enforcement at it, it's not going to end it. Now, if you really want to see streets be safer, you know, you brought up neighborhoods. If you want to see a neighborhood be safer, you take away the power from the gangs. Most of their power is coming from these drug sales. If you actually remove that, you now have a situation where anybody and their mom could sell, grow, buy, use. And it may sound a little bit ridiculous, you know, in some regards on that, but you know what? It just goes back to it's their body, their choice. But without the gang violence over turf wars and, you know, having police raiding the wrong homes and things like that, we end up with safer neighborhoods at the end of the day. Also, when it comes to rehabilitation, a lot of people who end up hitting rock bottom, they're scared to go and get help. And they're scared to go and get help because if they do, they're going to wind up in jail. And so the people who are actually wanting to finally end the struggle with drug addiction, they can't, because we're just going to throw them in a cage for, you know, 6 months, a year, whatever have you, and then their lives are ruined. They can't get jobs. They can't apply for any kind of federal assistance. Should they choose to have a change of heart and, you know, clean themselves up and everything, they can't serve in the military. There's a whole host of issues that come from, you know, that conviction. And so when we look at kind of the broad scope of everything, it ends up being a situation that needs to end, and it needs to end today.
Yeah, the two biggest groups that do not want to end the war on drugs would be the drug cartels themselves and the people who enforce the laws regarding the war on drugs, like the DEA and some of those groups, that would put both groups out of business. And regarding the war on drugs starting in the Nixon administration to prosecute activists and things like that, you can Google, if you do a search for Nixon aide, administration aide that recently admitted, or there's a tape that was found, and it's clear as day, and he admitted that the war on drugs was started so that they could violate people's rights and spy on activists, because most of those activists probably were using some kind of drugs that, you know, that's what they supposed. And it's funny how the NSA was promised to be just used for terrorism, but now it's also being extended into finding drug criminals. And so it's gone beyond the war against terrorism. And so there are actually, and you can look up other stats, there's about at least 40,000 no-knock raids every single year. There's a columnist named Radley Bradco that wrote on this and got all the stats together. So big, big problem that we're having. And it's been going on for a very long time. And we have other states like Colorado, Oregon, Alaska, Washington, D.C. I think California is voting on it. So there's a trend going to ending prohibition. And now you have people that could be considered refugees that are fleeing to these states so they could, you know, get the cannabis. And that's another thing. The cannabis was called cannabis originally, but the name was changed to marijuana, so it had a racial aspect to it, so that it became illegal in the 1930s. And probably because of the industries that didn't want hemp legal, because it could make paper and it could make ethanol, and so they kind of tainted it with the name marijuana. So, there's a lot there. And now, limited military involvement overseas. As a Marine, Craig, I'm sure you have some things to say about this. And this is another issue where some people believe we need to spend more money on the military. But what about the purpose of the Department of Defense to keep us safe and secure? What would be the best way to go about accomplishing that purpose?
Well, the best way to really go about accomplishing, you know, a safe and secure America is not projecting our power abroad. It is, you know, having the training at home, having the people that are willing to defend this country step up and do so, and leave them home. And again, people start, you know, in with the, well, what happens if Russia starts getting involved? Well, that means that it's not our flags on coffins coming home. It's their flags. If they want to step up and take that responsibility to police the world, have at it. But when we look at our involvement and what has happened over the decades, we can actually see connections of our involvement leading to eventual blowback. You can take, for example, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. You know, we actually were sponsoring the Taliban during the Afghan-Russian war. And once that was over, we left them high and dry, didn't help them rebuild, didn't help them really at all anymore. And so they got ticked off at us. And as the years go on, you had the first World Trade Center bombing in the 90s. You ended up having the Beirut bombing in Beirut, Lebanon. You end up having the Al-Qaeda links in Mogadishu and Somalia. And then eventually we also ended up having the World Trade Center attacks that Al-Qaeda all was involved in. So had we not been involved in the first place, or at least had a little bit more foresight, we wouldn't have what ended up happening. Now, a modern day example of what ends up happening when we get involved is you can look at Iraq. That was a country that I served in. I did 2 combat deployments there as an infantryman. And initiating the U.S. foreign policy, I saw what we were doing over there, you know. And there were times that it really ends up being a head scratcher on why we were there in the first place. You know, people cite things like weapons of mass destruction. We didn't end up finding them. Saddam was a bad guy. Well, now we have ISIS and they're worse. All of that is attributed to the fact that we invaded in the first place. If we would have stayed out of it and not violated international law, we would not have, you know, what the term that I've learned from some of my Islamic friends is the Kharijites, or the outsiders running around, you know, perverting the words of Islam to behead Christians and, you know, persecute different sects of Islam and anybody who basically disagrees with them. They never would have risen to power because as bad as Saddam was, he at least kept that country, you know, relatively stable. And ultimately, if a people is ready, or if the people are ready for freedom, they're going to fight for it on their own. We did it in our independence from Great Britain. Mexico did it in their, you know, fight for independence. Every country that's fought for independence, they came to a point where they're like, we're not taking your crap anymore. And so they fought back and they established the government that best suited their needs. And so when we start, you know, sending democracy via bomb, we just cause more harm than good. If the people aren't ready, they're not ready. And there's not really much that we can do about it. We can speak out against, you know, the humanitarian issues that arise, but there ends up being, you know, a point where we cannot be involved because if we are, we end up causing more hate and discontent around the world. And this has been proven time and time again.
And if we, so do you propose pulling out of the Middle East completely?
100%.
And would there be anything wrong with that? I mean, could we already declare victory? Are we cutting and running? What does real strength mean to you? How would you define strength in regards to a country like America?
Well, I know that sometimes the strongest person is the one that can admit that they're wrong. You know, it takes real courage to say, I screwed up. It takes a coward to continue to fight for what's wrong. And so if you want to see real courage and real victory, you would see our troops home. You would see America saying, you know what, we dropped the ball on this. And that to me would show that we won at the end of the day because we showed the moral courage to do so.
All right. Now, let's say you were in the Congress and you were in the debates regarding foreign policy. Let's say you had, you know, you were talking to military generals and strategists and et cetera, and you guys were looking at like a map of the world, which I imagine that they probably do, like just laid out on a table or something. And, you know, on the traditional map where, you know, it shows Asia on the left and Hawaii there in the middle of the Pacific, then North America, South America, Australia, Europe, Africa, and then India and Asia again. How and what should be our role? What should be our relations with other countries? How do you see our alliances? How do you see our trade policies? If you could get a crystal ball and or a hopeful crystal ball and think 10 years out from now, what would it look like? And if you're like an observer from space, I mean, you know, you can give your analysis of what you think it looks like now, but how should it look ideally, like in an ideal situation 10 years from now, if we started to make the right decisions?
Well, ideally, if I were to speak on what I'd like to see, it would be free trade among nations. You know, the ability for businesses to exchange goods without tariffs or anything inhibiting, you know, the sale of what that business has. You know, and that does foster better relationships with the people that are in different countries. I would also like to see a world where we're not arming up to fight the next war. you know, it would be a world where we're using aircraft carriers as nuclear power plants when there is an earthquake or a tsunami or some kind of a hurricane or something like that to help power, and then use, you know, the mobile hospital elements that are on there to help with the search and rescue efforts and helping people. That's, you know, real foreign aid. You know, that's helping people directly. Writing a check, you know, off to a government doesn't help the people. And so I could see relationships fostered where we are helping each other in times of need, but we're not just writing a blank check. We're all human. You know, every single one of us. And it doesn't matter if you're born on this side of the border or that side of the border. We're all born, you know, with gifts, talents, with freedom. And so I would like to see a world where we are cooperative with each other instead of trying to fight each other over every little thing.
All right. All right. And just to revisit one, you also mentioned prior in the war against drugs, the asset forfeiture. I saw recently a graph, very recently actually, where the number of money or value that has been claimed in asset forfeiture has exceeded the amount of total robberies and burglaries in the U.S. So there's actually more taken by the government from asset forfeiture than there is reported for robberies and stuff to the police where someone's purse or home was robbed. So that's something to think about. So, I mean, you know, these are real impacts and issues. Let me give you ask you some bullet list questions and just get like, you know, quick responses or just your initial thoughts on these, if that's all right, Craig.
Yeah, certainly.
These are kind of general issues and just to see what your approach is or what your answer is to them. How about accountability and transparency?
Well, I personally like, you know, the idea of transparency. We need to know where money's going. And I mean, you look at like the latest audit that was done on the Pentagon, and they don't know what happened to $6.5 trillion. That's not accountability. And we should be able to know as, you know, taxpayers where that money went. So I would be for things like increasing oversight. If money is being spent somewhere, we need to know where it's going. And it needs to be accurately reported to the American people. And that also goes for every single office, every single budget, every single, you know, department. They all need to be able to pass that line. And if they can't, they need to have their funds reduced by that amount.
All right. And all right. So the next issue is justice system.
You know, there is so much that needs to be done with criminal justice reform. It would take me a year to list things off. On the federal end, there are a couple of things that I know I'd like to do. One of them would be to end the 1033 program, which is the program that supplies military equipment at either wholesale cost, lower cost, or is actually given to local departments. Makes it so that there's a higher militarization of police, and that ends up distancing people. I would also look to start commuting sentences tied in with the war on drugs. You know, individuals who are convicted of nonviolent crimes need to be released and their sentences removed so that they can return to society.
Sure, not have a record so they can get a job, and you know, especially if they're nonviolent. And what about the election system?
The election system, I personally would like to see a time where there is no longer a party system, so to speak. I mean, it shouldn't be to the point where we're trying to divide people against each other. It should be a candidate who steps up and runs on their own issues. And each one has to be examined individually instead of being able to do this straight line voting. where you assume that since the Republican Party usually says XYZ, I'm just going to click Republican or Democrat or Libertarian. Each position should be weighed, each position should be measured, and each candidate should have to meet the specific criteria of every individual of what they actually want to see. And that would ultimately make it for a more educated populace.
Right. And small and mid-sized businesses.
When it comes to small and mid-sized businesses, we got to cut taxes, and we got to cut them yesterday. I'm actually a small business owner myself, and on top of taxes, you also have the licensing. I'm not sure that there's much that could be done at the federal end, but, you know, working with state legislatures, such as like Utah's Department of Professional Licensing, we need to move to a point where we're no longer requiring, for instance, if you want to braid somebody's hair and get $10, where they have to go to a cosmetology school. Things like that, to where people actually have the chance to succeed. And you do that with cutting taxes, getting regulations that harm you out of the way, and letting the free market work.
Sure, absolutely. The Institute of Justice has a lot of stories on situations like that, where a hair braider has to take, you know, a 600-hour course just to braid hair. What about government contracts, bailouts, crony capitalism?
My whole theory is that a business should be able to rise or fall on its own. If they have bad business practices, they should fail, and that's how it should work. The businesses that have the good ideas, the businesses that have great management, they're going to naturally succeed. But if they don't have those practices in place, that's their own fault. And those businesses that are able to innovate, that are able to have those market principles that help them grow, they're going to be able to take on those employees who may lose their job at the failed company. And so we have to get government out of the way. It's not the taxpayer's responsibility to bail out some CEO who screwed up.
Sure. And now, you did mention the NSA in Utah, and that's kind of a local issue. Are there any other local issues that we didn't bring up?
You know, if I were to encourage one thing of the state legislature here in Utah, it would be to get with the times when it comes to alcohol laws. You know, there are people who are going to drink, and a lot of the laws that are in place in Utah when it comes to alcohol laws are archaic. You know, that there's a small board that determines who gets a license to sell, who doesn't, and that stifles business growth. Because if a Chili's wants to serve alcohol and locate one of their franchises in a city, they are unable to because of the limit of those licenses. On average, I've seen where some years there's only maybe 10 licenses, you know, to be issued in a year. And so that means only 10 businesses, if they want to serve alcohol, are even going to be able to. And then there's laws like the Zion Curtain, where they have to build a wall, basically, to shield from eyesight the mixing of drinks. And, you know, these laws make it harder for business. On top of that, the price of some of these licenses is extravagant beyond measure. You're looking at about $50,000 to get a liquor license in Utah. And so it disincentivizes business from locating here if they decide that they're going to serve alcohol in their restaurant or if somebody wants to open a bar.
Sure. What about the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
You know, I am semi-familiar with it. I haven't had time to really look over the nitty-gritty of it. Yeah. So it's one of those things that it's so big that I honestly couldn't support it just because of how big it is. You know, when it takes 2,000 pages to write something, it's not free trade. It's not encouraging free trade. There's going to be hidden things in there that help out somebody who has a buddy in government, and that's usually how most of these bills are. They are so long that no congressman, no senator, you know, no legislator, no governing body is going to be able to read through the whole dang thing. And so it's pointless to pass them because we don't even know what's inside of it. You know, and I take the opposite stance of Nancy Pelosi. You know, she says we got to pass it to find out what's in it. I say we don't pass it because we can't see what's in it.
Yeah, and that was another big build item, the Affordable Care Act. Who's some of your favorite people, past or present?
If I were to name off just a few, you know, on a personal level, I've really enjoyed getting to know Governor Johnson over the last few months. He is a really stand-up guy. Whether or not you believe he's libertarian enough, you know, we can have that debate all day, and, you know, anarchists, minarchists, and all varying degrees of libertarians are going to debate until they're blue in the face. But he is a genuinely good guy, and I think his heart's in the right place. My dad is my personal hero. He taught me how to use my brain and how to think, how to question, how to examine the different sides of evidence before formulating an opinion. And I'd also have to go, in spite of his flaws, you know, George Washington, our first president, he was actually given the opportunity to be a king and have ultimate power. And on top of that, there were no term limits to, you know, stop him from continuing to be president until the day he died, but he chose to abdicate that power. You know, there's a few things in history that we can debate where he crossed the line. But ultimately, by surrendering the power that was offered him, I find that a very admirable trait. And I don't know very many people who necessarily would give that up.
Well, it reminds me of that movie, Lord of the Rings, where Frodo threw the ring into the fire. And I guess that's kind of like what George Washington did by not becoming the king, in a sense. Well, maybe this Thanksgiving, you know, you'll be talking about politics as being a House of Representative member, and maybe people across the country after Election Day on Thanksgiving will have something to be thankful for, and maybe by having some more competition in Congress. By the way, I heard Gary Johnson's doing not too bad in Utah. Is that right? He's kind of up there.
Depending on the poll, he's doing really well. I believe statewide he's in the high teens and low 20s, depending on the polling organization. The highest one I saw was a poll that Mia Love conducted, representative for 4th District, that found that 26% of respondents were supporting Gary Johnson. So 1/4 of that district that was polled were saying, we want something different. We're tired of the two-party system.
Yeah, and that's in a three-way race as well. So I can understand the argument, not that say I agree with it, but I can understand it where, you know, someone says a vote for, you know, the third party candidates is a vote against or the lesser of two evils or the bigger of two evils. But I would argue this for Congress, because there's less of a chance. You can't really make that argument as much for a congressional candidate like yourself. And Congress is also what's happening this November 8th. There's a lot less chance of risk or your vote, you know, being wasted, because if you were elected, you're not a single president. You're going to be in a body of 435 people, and most of the rest of them, you know, in the House of Representatives, most of the rest of them are going to be Republicans and Democrats. If someone's, you know, scared about voting this way or that, if you're going to take a risk at the congressional level. That's where change is supposed to be at. That's why our forefathers made the House of Representatives a 2-year term. So that way you can quickly pull the emergency brake if something, you know, if we're heading in the wrong direction before we drive off that cliff, per se. Craig, any final words of wisdom before we end the interview? And we appreciate your time, and we do wish you good luck in your campaign, and thank you for enlightening our audience, letting people think outside the box, letting people know that there's more going on this November 8th than the presidency, and there are candidates such as yourself as an option. Any final words of wisdom, sir?
You know, when you head to the ballot box on November 8th, examine the names. There's going to be more than just a D or an R on a ton of the ballots. And if you don't know, you need to take that as a lesson. Take it that you need to be more involved in the process, because ultimately where the elections are most important is going to be those down ballot races. Presidential candidates, they're going to get their media time. That's a give me. But there are people who are down ticket that they're limited to knocking on doors or, you know, attending limited civic functions. So if you don't know their names, it's important that the next time it goes around, you're looking at who is qualified to be on that ballot and really get to know the people who are seeking your vote. That's ultimately my wish across all of America. And if it turns out that a Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, or a Green Party candidate, whoever aligns most with your values, that's who you should vote for. I'd also encourage those who listen today, if they like what they heard from me, please go to my website and give a donation. We've only got about a month left to go. Still have to get those radio ads out there. Still got to get some signage out there, things of that nature. So I would appreciate any contributions to help me out.
Absolutely. Craig, C-R-A-I-G, the number 4, congress.org. If you look at your Department of Elections or your Secretary of State for your state, usually it's going that department will list all the candidates and you can research them. We have links to all of them on our website, libertarianprogressive.com. Most districts, about 70%, I would say at least, do have third-party candidates. So, you know, lucky for the electorate. But if you're in one of those districts that doesn't, I would consider donating to one of these candidates. After all, they are going to be in the U.S. House of Representatives. They are going to determine laws like war and peace and our economy and the justice system, civil liberties, etc. I mean, the Koch brothers are doing that, and they know Congress is where it's at. They're not even focusing on the presidential election. You know, those are the billionaire brothers, and they involve themselves in politics deeply. So Congress is where it's at. Craig, good to talk with you today. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a great night, and good luck again in your campaign, sir. We appreciate it.
I'll definitely appreciate you having me on tonight.